Thanks for downloading this show from PC One. Before we get rolling, here's a word from one of the folks who helped bring you this podcast.
This episode is brought to you by TrueCar. 3 million cars have now been sold using TrueCar, everybody, including the one that I drive. And for good reason. Like I've mentioned repeatedly, I'm not a negotiator, so buying a car, it's always been this really stressful experience for me at the dealership. TrueCar is perfect for anyone else who may feel the same way, because TrueCar lets you see exactly what other people paid for the same car that you want. Worked great for me, it'll work great for you. Now, I used it to buy a new car, but what many people don't realize is you can use it to buy a used car as well. In fact, more than 700,000 pre-owned vehicles have been sold via TrueCar. So here's how it works. You sign up at TrueCar.com, enter in the exact vehicle you're looking for, whatever bells and whistles you want, and then bam, you get to see what the car went for at several dealerships in your market. So it's really the most valuable piece of info you can take with you into the dealership. Then from there, you get hooked up with a TrueCar certified dealer that has that vehicle. So when you get to that dealership, again, you are armed with the information you need to get the car for a fair price. And speaking of fair price, get this, TrueCar users save on average more than $3,000 off MSRP. So when you're ready to buy a new or a used car, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features on TrueCar.com are not available in all states.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com presentation.
And we saw the guy get out, and you could see him with a knife in his hand, and we turned around and we're like, shit, and we just kept running.
And so there's this moment of, like, you project forward and you go, this is how people die.
And she and I hid behind a folding chair, like, desperately hoping that we would not be, like, sniffed out or discovered, because we had absolutely no idea what to do.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Backseat Rider, the podcast where I drive for Lyft and whoever ends up in the backseat of my car becomes the cast of this show. And this week, we are exploring the topic of close calls. And I know there are plenty of different, probably unlimited different kinds of close calls, like the time back in 2001, that I decided to send an email to a coworker making fun of my boss. And when I pressed send, I realized I didn't send it to my coworker. I sent it directly to my boss. Not good. I'm such an idiot. And I definitely would have lost my job if my boss had read it, but being the resourceful guy that I am, I casually walked over to her computer, which, by the grace of God, she was not sitting at the time. I opened her email, deleted the message, and then, like a badass, I even went into her deleted items folder and permanently deleted that same message to fully cover my tracks. I never got caught. But yeah, that happened. I'm an idiot. So this week, I took the following question out to the backseat riders. Have you ever had a really close call?
I'm a talker, right? Like, I enjoy connecting with people on more than, like, a superficial level.
Which is exactly what I want to hear as a Lyft driver with a microphone and a podcast. So everybody, meet Jake. That's his real name. 26 years old, St. Louis native. He directs plays here in Chicago, at least by night.
And my day job, I work for the League of Chicago Theaters, which is an organization that represents, like, the 300 or so performing arts organizations in the city.
Very nice. Very nice.
So a really creative guy, obviously passionate about the arts. And I drove him from his apartment, not far from Lincoln Square, down to his office near Millennium Park. Now, when Jake was 13 years old, he went on a pretty extreme adventure with his younger brother, 2 years younger, their uncle, and their grandmother.
Like, two children, an old lady, and one guy.
The four of them went on a kayaking and camping trip in Alaska, even though his grandma was pushing 70 years old.
She's a mountain lady. She left my grandfather after 50 years of marriage and decided that adventures were more her thing. And that's a big deal.
A big deal, especially because of where they were headed in Alaska.
Like, just trying to make it work. And we were in Alaska for like 2 weeks, and almost half that time was on this island all by ourselves. It was like the Jurassic Park of bears, really.
The Jurassic Park of bears, better known as Kodiak Island, which is right off the south coast of Alaska.
And we spent a little less than a week on Kodiak Island, which is where the grizzly man got, like, mauled back then, right? And,
The grizzly man?
The grizzly man. There's this movie, this documentary movie about him by Werner Herzog. And he's just this crazy guy who thought he was best friends with all the bears over there. Biggest bears in the world on Kodiak Island. They're these enormous grizzly bears, and they're, like, ferocious. And they killed this guy because he thought he was best friends with them and, like, whatever. And right after that happened, we decided to take a trip to Kodiak Island, which is kind of stupid.
I looked up the grizzly man, and sure enough, it chronicles the life of this guy named Timothy Treadwell, who was killed and then eaten by a grizzly bear back in 2003, which was just 2 years before Jake's trip. So the location of the camping and kayaking didn't exactly sit well with his mom.
So it was, you know, I think mom was in a state for 2 weeks, but dad was cool with it.
So without further ado, here is Jake's close call.
We kayaked all the way down this river on Kodiak Island, and we stopped to camp one day, and my uncle went off fishing with my brother, and leaving me and my grandma here on this island, and all of a sudden this family of bears comes out of nowhere and starts picking our campsite apart, and she and I hid behind a folding chair, like, desperately hoping that we would not be, like, sniffed out or discovered, because we had absolutely no idea what to do. And so there was just a little while there as a young man where I had to consider being mauled by a bear.
Oh my gosh. I'm guessing they weren't grizzlies, or were they?
They were enormous. Yeah, they were these enormous brown grizzly bears, and it was a mom and her kids, which got us really worried because, you know,
that's
they're
the
so
worst.
Protective. Yeah.
Right. Well, I've always read that bears aren't necessarily that aggressive, but when they're cubs are around.
Oh yeah, they're so protective. And we had been fishing like all the way down the river. So we were pretty certain there was this one bear that was tracking us the whole way down, because we kept pulling fish out of the water, right? Like, that makes sense. So yeah, that was that.
Oh my gosh. So how long were the bears in your campsite?
It was maybe about like 10-15 minutes. She was teaching them how to fish, which was actually, like, really awesome to watch. Like, if I wasn't fearing for my life, it'd probably be really cool.
So it was right on a river, then?
Oh, yeah. We were right in the middle of the water. We, like, literally camped on this little... It's just a big, stupid rock just kind of rising out of the water. But that's where we pitched our tents and everything. But you were, like, out in the middle of all of it.
That sounds beautiful.
It was gorgeous. Oh, freaking gorgeous. We took, like, bush planes out there, and it was so cool. But... Geez, that was intense there for a minute.
And so, what was your dialogue with your grandma once the bears moved on?
Where the hell are the boys? We just wanted help, right? Like, all we wanted were my uncle to come over the hill and scare everybody away, right? I think we just laughed about it. I think we cackled and cackled, and then played cards. I mean, that was par for the course, you know?
I took the same question to a woman I also picked up on the north side, close to Irving Park Road. And for any out-of-towners, that's a really main east-west arterial, as the city likes to refer to it. This woman, she needed a ride to a restaurant down in the western part of Lincoln Park, right off the Kennedy. And the reason that she chose that destination is that her friend was going to be picking her up at that location so that they could get right back on the highway and go backpacking up in northern Michigan. And her close call happened about 2 years ago, and similar to Jake, also happened in the wilderness on a camping trip.
It was a group of us who had gone backpacking together quite a bit, but we hadn't been gelling as a group in the recent past.
And having quite a bit of backpacking experience myself, not good to not be gelling with your fellow hikers, especially when the weather is bad. In the backcountry, bad weather plus a bad group dynamic oftentimes spells trouble.
And just being tired and cold and cranky, I mean, you don't expect cold rain on the 4th of July in the South.
They were in the Smoky Mountains, and it was day 3 of a 4-day hike. And she was kind of the de facto leader of the hike, having chosen the location and having chosen the route. Now, because it had been raining so hard, the streams that were along the trail were extra swollen, but they still had to be crossed.
So normally I'm someone who talks through a lot of decisions with people, and we just didn't talk through decisions. And I was the least experienced of the three. So, well, in some ways. And I hadn't done a lot of stream crossings. So I kind of figured, well, they're okay with it. I'm going to do it too. But I'm also a lot shorter than they are. So when the water hit the one guy below his knees, it hits me mid-thigh. But a lot of it for me was I had been the one who picked the route. And it was, I'm doing this. This is what I came here to do. I don't want to be a scaredy cat. Other people cross streams all the time. So a lot of it was not trusting my own judgment.
One of her friends had successfully just done the crossing, and now it was her turn.
So I was in the middle. So one had crossed already, and he turned around and gave me a look like, oh no. And I just kind of like looked at him and went, well, what the heck do you think we're going to do otherwise? Our cars were on the other side. Well, that was the other thing. We were a day and a half from our cars. So our cars were on the other side of the mountain. If we backtracked through where we hit the stream at that point, we had already crossed the stream about 7 times. And we didn't know how many extra stream crossings there were, so it seemed silly to go back and repeat when we might almost be done. And we were all cranky and weren't talking to each other properly, and we should have turned around. Instead, we forded a stream that we should not have been in. I got swept off my feet by white water and started going downstream. Floated on my backpack for probably only about like 15 seconds, but it's where it feels like 15 minutes.
Right.
She says in that moment, when she got taken by the rapids, that she had a legit I might die moment.
It was the moment I got swept up. There was a moment where I got pushed forward and then I somehow flipped onto my back and I realized that I'm floating on my back down a whitewater stream and I can kind of see ahead and there's these deep canyon walls closing in. And so there's this moment of like you project forward and you go, this is how people die. They go down the canyon and they can't get out. That was my, I was most scared. I could see, oh my God, I'm going toward a tunnel of white water. If I don't get out within the next 2 seconds, there's no way I'm getting out of here.
So after those thoughts flashed in her mind, survival instinct kicked in.
And caught myself by jamming my right foot in between some rocks. And when I stood up, the torque of the water spun my body around my ankle and cracked my ankle.
She felt a pop, but figured it was just a bad sprain.
Gosh.
I was so excited to be alive, I didn't even feel the pain. We got out of the stream. I laid down on the ground and told my friends, I think something's wrong. I didn't know my ankle was broken, actually. If I had known my ankle was broken, I think I would have been a lot more scared. I thought I had sprained it, and I've never sprained my ankle in my life. So I was like, oh, well, I just need to tape it up and take care of it. And then my friends started scouting for a different route so we didn't have to cross the stream again, but we realized we were going to have to follow the trail. That was the only way out. But, yeah, I think after that, it was kind of just, what do we need to do to get done and get out of here? And strangely enough, once we crossed the stream 3 more times and we got to a campsite, and in the Smokies, you're supposed to be camping on a permit, so they know where you are. And we were off our permit, and we were actually hoping at that point a ranger would come in and be like, why are you here? Unfortunately, no one came at that point, but the sun came out, so we were able to dry everything out and have a nice evening. So it was actually like this strange evening where it was really nice as I'm hobbling around camp. Wondering what the heck is wrong with my ankle and why it's so swollen. But
they hiked out to the nearest road, but that still left them miles away from their car. Fortunately, though, somebody came to the rescue.
And when we got out, I was terrified that we were just going to be sitting there and not even able to get a ride or anything because it was a Sunday, the day after the 4th of July. But we ended up with a ride from a trail volunteer.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Trail angel.
A trail. Oh, he was a true trail angel.
In the hiking world, a A trail angel is someone who comes to the aid of any hiker in distress, whether it's with extra food, extra gear, shelter, or in this case, a much-needed ride. And in my own experience, trail angels, they take many forms, but they always have a knack for being in the right place at the right time.
Meeting the trail angel was actually the best moment of that whole trip, because I now, this guy who was working the trail, we got to the trailhead and we said, do you know how we can get to the other side of the mountain? He goes, yeah, just give me an hour and a half to finish up here. I've got enough room in my truck. I'll drive you guys all back to your car. And it turns out that he's an Appalachian Trail volunteer. He had hiked the Appalachian Trail, through hiked it once and section hiked it another time. Totally used to helping hikers in distress. Drove us 2.5 hours back to our car, telling us fantastic stories the whole time. And I still keep in touch with him.
I mean, like, I'm 6'1", 200 pounds. I mean, I'm sure I can hold my own, but you still never know.
This passenger is 24. I picked him up one morning from his apartment near the lakefront in Lincoln Park and drove him to work down on LaSalle Street, which is in Chicago's financial district. His close call takes place not in the remote wilderness, but in the middle of a sprawling city.
So I went, I was in a study abroad trip through my university for 2 months, and we kind of traveled around Europe, and our trip ended, and me and two of my buddies were like, all right, so that's we're in Europe. We have easy access to anywhere. Let's spend another like weekend to go somewhere. So we went to Barcelona, obviously. And it was just the three of us, and we were just going to hang out on the beach and stuff like that. And one of my friends ran into this Swedish girl that he went abroad with the year before. And she was there with like 8 of her Swedish friends, which was, they're all very, very good looking women. And so we went out with them. And when you go out to Barcelona, you don't go out until like midnight, 1, and that's when you start drinking, hanging out, things like that. And so we went to this girl's apartment, and it was the three of us guys and then like her 6 or 7 friends from Sweden. And we went out to the club, and I was hanging out with one of the girls until the sun came up. And I got a cab back with her, and she wouldn't let me in because her boyfriend was there. So that was interesting enough.
So you took the cab back to
her. Yeah, but she didn't speak English, so it was there was obviously miscommunication there. And so I was like, all right, well, obviously I can't go in. I was like, well, can I at least like use your phone to call like a cab or like an Uber or whatever? I don't even think there's a button. She was like, no, like you cannot come in. So I just left. My phone was dead. All I had was my credit card, and the cabs don't take credit cards there. And I found myself walking around Las Ramblas at like 5, 6 in the morning by myself. And I'm walking, and I see this girl crying on the side of the street. And it was one of the girls that I was with earlier in the night. So I was like, what's going on? And she was like, nothing. I have no idea where I am. I was like, I'm on the same page.
She was American?
She was Swedish too, but she spoke better English.
Got it.
And so she was like, let's hop in a cab. And she was like, I'm sure we can, like, if we tell him a specific area, we could. So I told him my hotel. He knew where that was. And it was like kind of like in this alleyway or whatever. And I thought she had money on her, but all I had was my credit card, and the cabs there don't take American credit cards. So she didn't have money, so we get out of the cab, and neither of us could have paid for it. And so we hop out of the cab, and the guy asked for us to pay, and we said we didn't have any money, and we hopped out of the cab and started running, and the cab driver started chasing after us with a knife for about 3 or 4 blocks. And eventually we got away. He stopped chasing after us. But that was probably the longest night of my life.
Like, what did you learn about what fight or flight means?
So, like, I mean, it was literally just like we were running because we couldn't pay our cab. So, like, we're just going to run and, like, a block down and then just turn. And we're like, all right, we're fine. But then we started running out of the cab, and that was our main instinct. And we saw the guy get out, and you could see him with a knife in his hand. And we turned around, and we're like, shit, and we just kept running. And I still have never seen that girl ever again to this day. She's from Sweden. I don't think I'll ever see her again. But I don't know, like, I saw the knife, and I was like, I'm not messing with that. I have no idea what this guy is capable of. And so I was just like, you know what? I'm almost 100% sure I could outrace this guy. So I just turned to the girl to the right of me, and we just started running. We kept running for, like, 4 or 5 blocks, and the guy was chasing after us the entire time. It was a good time. It was fun.
All right, I have one more close call story that, in my mind, was the most harrowing of all the riders I drove this week.
And he said, honestly, if you don't get this and, like, be able to use it, you will die.
Who that passenger is, who said that to him, and how he ended up in that situation in just a moment. But first, quick mention of one of the sponsors that is helping me bring you Backseat Rider for free each week, and that is Blue Apron. And I'm so glad to have Blue Apron as a sponsor, because I've been cooking with them since well before Backseat Rider was even a concept. It's so much fun. You learn so much about cooking by doing it, and the meals themselves, they're challenging without being overwhelming. It's like this perfect balance. I got a box on the way this week, in fact, which I'm very excited about. And how it works is this. You sign up, they deliver a box of fresh ingredients right to your door with step-by-step recipes that have pictures on them to guide you through the process. And you then get these beautiful, delectable home-cooked meals. Now, as a Backseat Rider listener, you get to try Blue Apron and get your first 3 meals for free with free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/backseat. Trust me, try it. You will thank me. Cheaper than takeout, and you will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. Again, that is blueapron.com/backseat. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Hey everyone, I'm Maggie McGrath, a staff writer at Forbes magazine and your new host for a show called Forbes on Trump.
Politicians are all talk, no action.
I'll be speaking with the editors and writers who are reporting on the 45th president. We'll hear what they're finding out about his wealth, his business associates, and the ways in which he and his policies are affecting the economy, consumers, and all aspects of the business world.
Somebody has to come out and tell it like it is.
Along the way, we'll dive into Forbes archives, which contain decades of information that will add context to the current White House administration.
So listen to this. Listen to this.
That's Forbes on Trump on Podcast One.
Subscribe now at iTunes, and don't forget to rate, review, and share.
Tusk. That was the Lyft app saying, next stop, dropping off Tusk. Now, a lot of times, the computer, she gets the pronunciation of people's names all wrong. But in this case, she got his name right. Tusk.
What kind of name is that? I've never met anyone named Tusk.
The truth story is, my birth mom and dad were in Hell's Angels, and they named me after the Fleetwood Mac song.
Tusk is 31 years old. He works in the Loop, and unlike some of my other passengers, he has had many close calls over the years.
Yeah, it's never just been one thing for me. It's been like a collection of experiences that if I ever find myself in like a pickle, I look back and say, okay, well, Tusk, if you're brave enough to pack 2 suitcases and move across the world to teach English to a country you can't read, you can't write, you can't speak, you don't know where or how to get around,
and you end up getting a job, a beautiful condo, and living an amazing lifestyle for 2 years, odds are good you can handle this. Yeah.
The 2 years that he's talking about, he spent throughout Southeast Asia. An epic voyage, sounds like. And he returned from that voyage about a year ago.
When I moved back, I got contracted somehow two different forms of pneumonia at the same time in my lungs, which then turned into a form of skin cancer where I had to have two blood transfusions and almost died during each of those.
During the transfusions?
Meanwhile, battling HIV on top of that.
Tusk has been living with HIV since he was 20.
Like, are you aware of how you contracted it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was seeing a guy, and he lied to me. I'm not the only one that he's lied to.
The diagnosis stunned him initially, as it would anybody. But it actually didn't take Tusk very long to get into a positive mindset.
We thought we were very, unlovable. I was going to be treated like some contagious freak. You know, no one would love me. And I went through that for like maybe a couple weeks. And with the support of my family, my mom and dad, mostly my mom, I just snapped out of it. It was the military mentality that I live in. My mom being 10 years retired, my dad being 25.
From the military?
Yeah. You don't sit and pout and say, poor me. That doesn't solve anything. It's not productive. So you just, you get up and do what you need to do when you're supposed to do it and how, and that's the end of it. It's not a conversation.
That positive mindset was tested to the nth degree when he got back from his stint in Southeast Asia this past year, and then came down with pneumonia. So here's his close call.
I moved back from Bangkok around April. I was in the hospital by May, and I started having these fits where I just couldn't breathe. The pneumonia was in my lungs, and the doctor put a big oxygen mask on my face, and I couldn't even breathe through that. And he said, honestly, if you don't get this and, like, be able to use it, you will die. And
he said that to you?
Yeah. And I thought, well, I have two nephews who mean the world to me. And I thought, well, Tusk, so this is where it is. If you die now, at 9 and 7, they're going to go through life and say, oh, I used to have a really great uncle, and then he got pneumonia, and he just wasn't tough enough to make it through. Uncle Tusk just wasn't strong enough. Or they can go around and say, well, my uncle's lived and traveled half the world, beat off pneumonia twice, and is still looking good and kicking ass. So those were my options, and I gave it all that I had. I knew that this was it. Do you want to live or do you not?
And on top of HIV, on top of two forms of pneumonia, Tusk also came down with a form of skin cancer this year.
They put me into a medical coma for 3 months that I do not remember anything of. And then I woke up.
He woke up, and he kept fighting. And on the day I drove him, he was headed downtown to his job with this positive and candid demeanor and also this distinctive charm and wit, as me and the other passenger in back noticed.
Wow. Okay, so you have been living with HIV for, you said, 10 years?
Yeah.
And
I know I look good, though.
You do.
Yeah.
You do, man.
You know, a positive attitude... something I learned in life is you can't control or change what happens to you, but you can change and control how you respond to it.
And in my mind, if anyone I've met or driven is qualified to dispense advice like that, after what he's been through this past year, it's Tusk.
I mean, obviously through time and years, you know, I learn more and more to, like, accept myself and love myself unconditionally. And, you know, this was not my fault. You know, I do not deserve this. Now that I have it, the question is, what am I going to do with it? Am I going to use it to help other people make clearly better decisions than I was making? And am I going to use this to help be an example to other people that have it, that maybe are not handling it as well as I am, that, hey, this is not the end of the world. You know, no, everyone is not going to come running to you and giving you a hug and a pat on the back and say, poor you, you know. If I can do it, you can do it. Look what I'm doing. You know, I went to college. I got my degree. I have a career. I work. I have friends. You can do all of these things. This is not the end.
Tusk says in a situation like that, it's only the end if you choose it to be.
The worst thing you can ever do is stop trying.
All right, anyone who listened last week knows that I've recently been in this kind of inspiration-seeking mindset, which is why I took the opportunity right there to ask Tusk his advice after hearing his close call story. I was so inspired by it. And you can check out a picture of me with Tusk if you want to see what he looks like by going to my Facebook page. Anthony Ponce is where I'm at. Last name is spelled P-O-N-C-E. You can also check out a picture of me with Jake, who had the grizzly bear encounter. Those guys were nice enough to let me snap a quick picture before they got out of the car that day. You can also find them on Instagram with me. I'm at Anthony Ponce TV. And before I sign off for the week, some good news. The Backseat Rider feedback line is back up. And I've actually been getting a lot of calls from around the globe, believe it or not. And the one I want to play today comes all the way from the UK. And it's in response to episode 23, which was the episode that I called The Internationals. And if you'll recall, that's the episode I asked people to call in with their experiences from other countries that changed their perspective of the U.S. So listen to this one.
Hi, Anthony. My name is Sophia. I'm calling from London. I just listened to your immigrants podcast, and when I was 13, I went with my family to Iran to visit my dad's family, and it was a really great experience. The people there were really welcoming. It's a beautiful country, but I was becoming really resentful and frustrated at having my freedom taken away because, of course, I had to cover up my hair and my skin. Even though it was only temporary, I felt really frustrated that the women had to sit at the back of the bus and the back of the subways. It was just really getting to me, and so I would push the limits in without really recognizing the consequences. And one night I was walking with my family in the city of Tehran, and this white van just pulled up beside me, and these two men who were officers, they jumped out, they opened the back of the van and were telling me to get in. And when they opened the van, I could see about half a dozen other fighting-looking young women. Almost as soon as the men had jumped out of the van, what felt like a sea of tiny, old Iranian women surrounded me and made like a wall between me and the officers. And everyone was yelling. The officers were yelling at me to get in because the little bitty ends of my hair were poking out at the end of my scarf. And the old women were yelling at the officers to leave me alone, and they were yelling at me to run away. So that's what I did. At the time, I just thought, wow, that was a really close call. Good for me. But it's been 10 years since that happened, and I really am struck by how these women put themselves in danger to protect a perfect stranger. It was really mind-blowing. Something that I thought I knew everything about the country because my father told me about it, but turned out that I did not.
All right, thank you so much for the call, Cece. That was a scary as hell situation you were in, especially if you were only 14 years old at the time. It's incredible that happened and very inspiring that complete strangers came to your aid like they did there. Thank you so much for sharing. I love being able to pass that along to Backseat Rider listeners. Talk about close call there as well. And if you have a story to share about a close call, again, the hotline, it's back up and running. So give me a call, 312-709-4667. Again, that is 312-709-4667. I put that number in the show notes as well. Again, looking for your close call stories. Doesn't have to be a near-death thing like my passengers this week. Could be anything, even if it's a stupid one like mine when I accidentally sent my boss an inappropriate email. Could be something like that, too. You could also share it with me on Facebook. Send me a message. And if I read it on the show, I can always keep your name out of it if you prefer. And thank you to everyone who has been calling in. And I apologize if I haven't played your phone call up to this point. I'm actually thinking of putting a bunch of great calls I've gotten into kind of a bonus episode. If you guys think that's a good idea, let me know. I'm always looking for feedback on the show, which you can leave as well. What I'm doing well, what I could be doing better, and also show topics, everybody. Do you have a burning question that you'd want to hear strangers comment on under the shade of anonymity? Let me know what that question is. Always looking for topic ideas. And you can always reach me on Twitter as well. My handle is AnthonyPonceTV. All right, that's it for me for this week. If you are liking this show, please, I'd really appreciate it if you left me a review and a rating on iTunes. It would really help me out. Also, please use my Lyft promo code. If you haven't signed up for Lyft yet, the code is just the name of this podcast, Backseat Rider, all one word. Lyft is not a sponsor of the show, by the way. Also, the link for your free Blue Apron meals, they're in the show notes. It's blueapron.com/backseat, so take advantage of that. You will thank me. Backseat Rider is edited by Bob Gilmartin and produced by me with the help of Louis Kazmarek. Also, a big thanks to WTTW and WTTW.com for their support of this podcast. As always, look for new episodes of Backseat Rider every Wednesday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and you can subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes.